commercial test. Commercial and business user constituency, Tech Alex Surratt, room Opal at 3:15.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. I think the recording has started, so we'll go ahead and start. A little 5 minutes late, but I think we can accommodate others that will be joining. I know we're still waiting on our GNSO counselors to arrive, Phil and Susan. Thank you all for taking the time to be here. This is the business constituency open meeting. My name is Chris Wilson, chair of the business constituency. And we've got a full agenda scheduled to be here for a few hours, but depending on how we proceed, maybe we can get out a little early. Perhaps just as per protocol, we can go around the table, have everyone introduce themselves, and maybe even their affiliation. Since this is just the BC, we can just tell them which company you're with or association, and then we can start it up. So, Steve, why don't we start on my left? To you.
Thanks. Steve DelBianco, Vice Chair for Policy Coordination, and I run a trade association in Washington, D.C. called Net Choice.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hiba Hussain. I'm based in D.C. at Google on our public policy team.
Hi, Aparna Sridhar, also at Google.
Andrew Harris, Amazon.
Hi, Brian Huseman with Amazon.
Claudia Martinez, Louis Vuitton.
I'm Mourad Militi. I'm from Internet Service Provider Tunisia.
Nivaldo Cleto from Brazil, IR Task Services, and a member of CGI Brazil.
Claudia Sali, TNT.
Mahmoud Latour from Egypt and Jordan.
Cheryl Miller, CSG representative, and I'm with Verizon.
Andrew Beck, Abe Global, and I'm your outreach chair.
Cecilia Smith with Fox.
Okay. I'm Jimson Olufi, Vice Chair, Finance and Operation. I represent AFICTA, Africa ICT Alliance, about 25 countries in Africa, member of the alliance. And my day job is as CEO of Contemporary. We build and manage data centers and do IT consulting. Thank
you. And this is Chris again. I neglected to mention that I too work for 21st Century Fox. That is my quote unquote day job. Although I think maybe ICANN's more my day job now, and my sideline job is working for a company. Great. Thank you all very much. We've got it right. If you're looking at the agenda right now, though, it's kind of small. We do have a little bit of time allotted for bring up any other topics of interest that aren't perhaps listed in the agenda. Some of this is obviously procedural administrative topics, but also some substantive policy topics as well. So if we have the opportunity, if there are any other topics of interest folks want to raise, now would be a good time to do so. So I'm looking around. I don't see any. I should also neglected to mention there are some fine folks from the BC on participating remotely. I see Gabby, Jay Chapman, and John Berard on as well. So if there are anything that any of you all would like to raise, please either type it or feel free to raise your hand and speak up. Okay. So if not, I don't see anything, then we can maybe hit the pause button on GNSO review until hopefully Phil and or Susan can show up. And maybe, Steve, if this works for you, we can turn directly to the policy calendar and get in a little bit of discussion on what's going on there. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. Chantel, would you – thank you. You're ahead of me. She's loading the policy calendar. And I've asked in the Adobe if any of you are not on the BC list and should be, I can email you the policy calendar as well. I sent it out last night. Let's skip directly to Channel 2 on comments that are due to file. Current calendar would say that we have only four of them that we need to focus on right now. The first two together are a combined comment that the BC is trying to rationalize our approach on next generation registration directory services along with registry data access protocol, or RDAP, and then ThickWho is. We drafted these comments right after the first of the year. Barbara Warner and Cheryl Miller did the initial drafting, and then we had plenty of help with edits that were done by Andy and Aparna, and then Susan Kawaguchi. We circulated that in the middle of February, thinking that comments were due February 15th, but there was an extension. They're now due March the 18th, which is just next week. So this is a golden opportunity for BC members who are concerned about the current discussions of ThickWho is in implementation. We just had a very substantive discussion of that with Cyrus and other ICANN staff and board in the CSG interaction with the board. So if any of you missed that, that was an opportunity to explore why the delay of implementation of a consensus policy that was agreed to 2 years ago. And Cyrus gave us an answer. Now let's see whether the comment we have appropriately reflects that. So the draft comment was the first attachment to the policy calendar that I circulated. So any of you who have your computers up can pop that up, and I'll take a brief cue on how we want to modify or strengthen the comment we're making on RDAP and ThickWho is. I see Denise. Anyone else? Go ahead, Denise.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's a really good foundational draft. I think just given the circumstances of how this is evolving and also the interest of the IP and the ISP on this interest, it would be good to add, I'm happy to provide some edits for people's consideration. I think it would be good to add a little bit more context and history on the ThickWho is and the need for implementation.
Thank you, Denise. People will be traveling through the end of this week. So it is kind of a challenge for us to knit together significant changes. So I do want to pay attention to the bottom of page one, top of page two. We did our best to recap what the BC has said before about ThickWho is and our strong support on it. And there are several footnotes there that point to previous comments going back to 2013. And all that's laid out in terms of history and coverage. I think the most important part is what do we want to say about going forward? Because we acknowledge that the migration to ThickWho is a temporary step towards the eventual completion of work on the RDAP, and we're eager to see it implemented for COM and NET. But we have heard from staff, and we heard today, that .com and NET won't be addressed until the next phase of the implementation. They're not even part of the current implementation. So would we want to say something stronger to accelerate, change your plan, make COM and NET part of the next phase or not? Let's think about what we want to do normatively, not descriptively, and going back. But what do we want our position to be? And Denise, invite a dialogue. How do we want to strengthen what we've said as opposed to just recapping what we said before?
Susan Kawaguchi, for the record. What I'm just not understanding is why they are delaying the implementation of the ThickWho is based on RDAP, which wasn't even created until after the board had signed off on the implementation of ThickWho is. And it does create a quagmire for the registrars. We should just move forward with the implementation of ThickWho is. And maybe I have a slanted view because of the company I work for, but 100 million records is not that many records. So I think VeriSign can do the job and could do it correctly. They just need to get moving, and the board needs to tell them, or ICANN needs to tell them to do that.
Maybe Phyllis can help. Yeah, look, in the middle of page two, we acknowledge what the staff is saying is that implementing RDAP is phase one of the ThickWho is. So for some reason, staff decided to make that phase one, and phase two becomes the thick part. So this is the last paragraph of the thick section of the comment. So if we want to recommend that the priority of phase one, two be reversed, for instance, or recommend that they be combined, or recommend that they be left in this order but accelerated, we should try to be as explicit as we can be. I mean, they don't listen to us very much anyway. But let's at least be explicit. And I was explaining to Denise yesterday that when the BC typically will start with a policy position, and I always catalog it with footnotes on the foundation, And then every time we revisit those and submit them as part of a new comment, that's a chance for us to refine and update in the face of new facts on the table or in the face of what we see staff doing to make a new position. So we usually build our positions and policies incrementally. That's the beauty of having a continuity in the BC. So incrementally, looking at the way they want to phase the work, we can be as pointed as we can. It only requires two sentences. We believe that the phasing is reversed. It's in the wrong order. Or we believe you should do them together. And let's be clear about that. Did you have something else, Denise?
Yeah, just Denise Michelle. So the GNSO in developing the policy on who is did not develop the thick who is policy with an exception for when the IETF got done with RDAP. They were working on RDAP when the GNSO developed the policy on thick who is. The board adopted the GNSO policy to implement thick who is in these remaining registries. They did not give them an out for RDAP or a future RDS effort. So the policy does not say implement thick who is in these remaining registries unless the IETF moves on RDAP or unless the GNSO creates a PDP on RDS. So I'm also concerned, quite frankly, about the precedent this sets of implementing consensus policy developed by the GNSO unless major registries disagree with it. There's a concerning pattern of activity by staff when it comes to their responsibility for implementing consensus policy approved by the board. So there's, I think, that sort of overlay as well.
And I do believe that thick who is came before the RDAP. Is that right?
RDAP has been in the IETF pipeline for many, many, many years.
No, but when did GNSO adopt it as consensus and make it part of the contract?
Thick who is?
RDAP. Bruce told us today that both thick who is and RDAP are required to be implemented under the contract for CommonNet today. So there's no need to worry about contract changes.
I don't think, someone else may know, but I don't think the GNSO had a policy reference to RDAP. I think RDAP, because the IETF was working on RDAP when they negotiated the 2013 RAA, they put a placeholder in there for the implementation of RDAP should the IETF complete its work. I really don't think the GNSO had a role in RDAP.
Bruce made the point that they're both in the contract. That's good. But you're making another point that thick who is was a consensus policy of our policymaking body. Port 43 was added to the contract, but it wasn't because we said it would be in there. So how ironic to have the contract element on RDAP be put in front of the policy that we would. So it's, I think it's about reversing the order. If I get that right, I'd look for any objections to potentially changing. All right, because the last part of our comment is about wanting things to be synchronized. And we can make a very common sense argument that in the synchronization, please reverse the order of phase one and phase two. Any objections? Okay, so I will look for the drafters and the three of you at the table here. Help us to come up with a paragraph or two and circulate it before people get on the planes to leave this week. We can work on it in our spare time here in Marrakesh. Thank you. Any other comments on the first one? Great. I know that I note that we have BC members who were in the PDP for the Next Generation Registration Directory Service is the potential replacement for who is. And fortunately, Susan, you've been a leader on this since the expert working group. Andrew Harris is with us from Amazon also on that. Jeff Noakes, I don't think, is here today. And Beth Allegretti, who's one of Cecilia's colleagues. Are there anything to update us on what's going on in that PDP?
We're meeting tomorrow. So we have face-to-face for 2 hours. We're already facing the opposition that we always do with certain elements in the community, but no. Except I think Chuck is doing a really good job of organizing the work. So.
Excellent. Thank you. So let's turn to the second item on the policy calendar. Andrew, anything you wanted to add on that? Okay, great. Thank you. Sorry. So the next one is the privacy and proxy services accreditation. So privacy and proxy services are employed by registrars to hide the identity of a registrant, right? And they have certain obligations to relay and reveal if someone has a legitimate need to contact or learn the identity of the registrant. The privacy and proxy services had never been regulated in any significant way until the new GTLD expansion, and we used the leverage of that expansion, and the BC was really the leader on this, to get ICANN to come up with a plan to say that a proxy and privacy provider needed to be accredited, just the same way that registrars were accredited. And so we were able to get that into the 2013 registrar agreement, and then we turned around and got the new GTLD program to say that you can't distribute new GTLDs unless you use the new RAA. So we used leverage upon leverage to try to get our policy preferences baked into the process. And I guess the good news about that is we got it baked into the process, but the bad news is now we have to eat our own cooking because it's time to build the accreditation for privacy and proxy. So we did all the work to get it in there as an imperative, but now we need to do that work. So I'm pleased that we've got a comment drafted by Ellen Blackler. I circulated it over the weekend. It's very brief, and Andrew Harris, you and Andy Abrams of Google both raised a question about this financial penalties. So if any of you open the second attachment on my policy calendar, you'll see Ellen's draft, and then I highlighted in yellow what Andrew and Andy have in mind. Let's have a brief discussion about removing that, which was your suggestion. Go ahead.
Sure. We just felt that fines in this place seemed a little superfluous, that deaccreditation is more than appropriate to handle any issues that arise for noncompliance. And that's how these matters are typically held from an enforcement perspective. And also the notion of financial penalties had been considered by the group that was reviewing this initially, and it was something that was not included. So it doesn't seem like it's going to go anywhere anyway, so we think we should just stick with the deaccreditation.
Anyone else want to speak to that in the queue? Ellen said she didn't have a lot of ownership of the point. She simply was building on the shoulders of our previous comment, and I think Andy and Andrew have suggested we simply drop the words "and financial penalties" from the second paragraph. And again, folks, this is the second attachment to the policy calendar email I sent last night. Susan.
So, and I don't know why this, at least I have not focused on this element of it, but we did have a discussion with a staff member where there's some within ICANN. I'd always assumed that if the accreditation would require a contract, and they're talking about not having a contractual agreement to accredit the proxy providers. So, not sure what the stick is then. So, if there's no contract and they just have to agree to best practices or something, I'm not sure. There's no clarity there. I don't think they know yet. So, I think we need to decide also, is there a contract? And then, you know, is there or is there not financial penalties? I could go either way on that. I don't, you know, deaccrediting someone or the threat of deaccrediting may be sufficient. But if there's no contract, how is compliance going to force somebody to act? So I think we need to just put that in there, that this should be a contractual relationship.
These comments closed the 16th of March. So Susan, there are four bullets in the draft. We need a bullet in front of them, one sentence long,
okay,
raising a concern that having done all the work of designing an accreditation program, that it would be a failure to not require the contracts be employed to require accreditation. So I'll look to you to draft that one sentence, and we'll insert it in there. And I do generally see support to removing the financial penalties part. Marilyn.
I'm just going to make a very quick historical reference. I support removing it from this submission, which does not change the historical submission, so I just want to make that comment. But I just want to mention something. We went through this in the past quite some time ago, and I mean really some time ago, maybe 2002, 2004. we could not, we really struggled with the resistance against the, what was called by at that time, the nuclear option of de-accrediting. So, you know, I support the filing, but I think we need to begin to prepare ourselves for making it clear that they need to enforce the, quote, nuclear option. You kill a few birds and fewer come to your yard.
Marilyn, that suggests that we link the first and second bullet. The first bullet talks about enforcement and compliance. The second bullet talked about decreditation, but we should link them to suggest that part of enforcement is the eventual escalation of enforcement steps to the ultimate step of decreditation. Does that make sense? Between the first and second bullet? Okay. Any other comments on this?
Well, so
go ahead, Susan.
I think we could link it to the process for registrars being de-accredited, because they don't, if they're issued a notice of breach, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be de-accredited, but it does mean that they can't take new registrations.
Right.
So, and I found that out with the EuroDNS and the Facebook.com issue. So they were forced, the first notice of breach that ICANN finally issued was, you know, the impact was they didn't lose their accreditation. They just couldn't take any new registrations. So, you know, it's one step before.
Yeah, but so prior to decreditation, prior to losing your accreditation, there is an interim step in the registrar side where you are prohibited from accepting new services, new registrations. And I understand the new registrations, but this isn't about registrations. It's about privacy and proxy services. And they could provide a service to somebody that's been registered for years. So what's the parallel? Is the parallel that they wouldn't be allowed to accept new customers?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the way I would view it, so maybe we need to make that pretty clear.
Okay. And the time to do this is going to be today so that we can circulate it. And I'm happy to be the keeper of the document. If you send me an email with crude text, I'll plug it in and circulate something else hopefully tonight or tomorrow. Any further comments on privacy and proxy? And thanks to Ellen Blackler. I don't think she's on the phone, but she did a great work on this over the weekend. Berard, you got something for us as well?
Do we need to acknowledge the effect of compliance and deaccreditation on the people who are making use of the service? Do they just get shifted to some other provider? Do they lose their protection? Do we want to make some comment about that?
Well, that's why the first step with the notice of breach works, because they don't have to find a new proxy service provider to move these to.
Very good answer, Susan. So if we emphasize the notion that one of the escalation steps in enforcement is to suspend their right to take any new customers, that does not jeopardize the services provided to existing customers. Eventually, John's concern would come to fruition if decreditation happened, right? So eventually that has to happen. And I don't know for sure that that's a concern we need to own, since we're dealing with somebody who was accredited under certain expectations and conditions and failed to meet them, failed to remedy the breaches that were told to them by ICANN compliance. And once you've walked up to the top step of this escalation ladder, there are consequences. Unfortunately, they do reflect on people that went in and used the services and will have to find a new provider for their privacy and proxy. That's not the same thing as changing a domain name. It isn't. The domain name stays the same. They simply change who their privacy proxy provider is with the registrar. Agreed?
All right, Steve, this is John again.
Go ahead, John. So
when a registrar gets deaccredited, then, you know, ICANN, I think, has the role of pushing the registrations to a new registrar. There are certain aspects of the registry agreement that allows a registry to shift registrations between registrars. But I just, you know, in the current mood of focus on internet users and the role of registrants in within the ICANN ecosystem, I just wonder if we would serve ourselves if we make some reference to registrants rather than not. That's all. Maybe it's more a political concern of mine than it is a practical one.
Thank you, John. I look forward to an email from you to BC Private in the next 6 hours with a sentence about our sensitivity to the needs of registrants. Now, again, we do not mess with their registration. This says that you still have your registration, but the folks you use for your privacy proxy has to change. So it's as simple, you right, move to a new vendor, and then you update your record. Sorry, John, go ahead.
No, it may just be that we acknowledge that that there needs to be a clear path for registrants to maintain the protections that they initially sought. That's all.
I mean, if the BC were using Black Knight as hosting and our hosting provider went out of business, I don't believe ICANN provides a path for registrants to migrate to a new hosting service. And to me, there's really no difference between a hosting service, a privacy proxy service. It's just the service providers that are outside of the orbit. And I don't understand why we're going to impose special obligations on ICANN to help migrate a registrant who was using a third-party privacy proxy service. John, did you want to follow up on that?
Only that we're creating a burden on registrants at a time when there is a lot of attention on the on registrants as the point of the spear for internet expansion on a global basis. So as I said, it's probably more a political concern than it is a practical or business concern.
Thanks, John.
So I'll draft a sentence or two and send it off to you.
Great, and send it to me, but please copy BC Private, and then I'll try to assemble all this. Marilyn?
Just very quickly, Steve, let me just parse what you just said and disagree with only one part of it. A web hosting service is a commercially provided service that ICANN has nothing to do with. You're totally on your own. There's no accreditation, and we're not trying to, as the BC or as the ICANN, to establish any kind of standards. The proxy service we are trying to bring under a policy guidance. So I think that's the distinction.
Fair point. Anything else on this? Thank you, everyone. Next one is a draft of how to do a framework of principles for these cross-community working groups, which can be likened to a year-long root canal in most cases. I can speak from experience. Comments don't close until the 2nd of April, so we have plenty of time, but we don't have any volunteers on this yet. So I will ask very quickly if there are volunteers in here who've been in cross-community working groups of any kind and can help us to read this set of reports to develop a framework. So it's a charter to develop a framework to guide the formation and operation of future cross-community working groups. So can I have some volunteers? Thank you, Marilyn. Appreciate that. Anyone else? That's a really good start. Marilyn, that's going to be very helpful. Thank you. The next one is item 5, charter amendments to GTLD Registry Stakeholders Group. We discussed this on our previous call, and I suggested that a few of the BC members who happen also to be in the registry constituency, in some cases with a whole portfolio, in other cases as a brand, whether there are insights and concerns that these companies can share with the BC. And if so, that would give the BC, in our perspective, the perspective of registrants and users, not the perspective of a registry operator, because we would love to understand whether there's comments we potentially could make on their charter. And a few of you took that as an action item on the last call. Some of you responded with an email, but it'd be good to go back through that. I'm thinking of Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and others. Again, this is on the registry's new charter and the amendments that have involved there, which don't recognize the existence of brands at all, and base the weighted voting in the registry's constituency from now on based on a combination of number of registrations and the dollars of fees they pay to ICANN. So any of you who were involved in that or your colleagues, you have any insights for us?
Cecilia Smith, so I did not participate in that first call, but would be very interested in joining to help with comments on that. I just came back from the registry stakeholder group. The BRG, the brand registry group, is in an association currently as an observer, which means that we finally have access to hear what is happening in the registry stakeholder group, which we've not been privy to until today. Part of that is the next step is to give us full membership access in the sense that we can have a vote as an association. And then from there, I think we just have to continue pushing harder to get more recognition from the brand's perspective. We do have members within the brand registry that are voting members within that space. So we have 10 voting members, and then I think 3 members that don't vote. So
under the new charter?
As regardless of the charter, as just members of the registry stakeholder group.
The new charter is the only thing we're commenting on.
Then yes, we will.
And so we want to understand if the new charter bears any comments from the BC perspective. All of you who were part of that, didn't the brand registry group approve this charter as well? We were told that they did. Yes, Andrew, they did. So the brands have already spoken.
Right.
Whether they had a vote or not, they stood up and said, we like the new charter. And that would be a message to me to stand down unless there were things that companies, BC members, didn't get that would end up benefiting the BC perspective.
We are, so the brand registry group is still talking to the registry stakeholder group, so if I can get back to you on that in a couple of days.
Because the charter is up for approval now. So we're not going to do any wordsmithing. We can mostly express a concern that business perspectives, business registrants,
sure,
are not getting the proper amount of attention. Andrew.
Thanks, Steve. So from Amazon's perspective, we don't have problems with the charter revisions, but Cecilia, if you go back and do some research and if there's something that you do want to consider, you know, raising in comments, I'm happy to work with you on it.
Same with Google. This is Aparna.
Great. Thanks, everyone. We're going to move to the last topic, which is the recommendations of the Geographic Regions Review Working Group. This was a working group that is trying to continue ICANN's efforts to increase geographic diversity at ICANN, and those comments closed at the end of April. Plenty of time on that. But over the weekend, Andrew Mack, who had volunteered to draft comments, did an analysis of the recommendations, and then he's going to work with Jimson and Cheryl to come up with a recommended BC comment. Andrew, we have some time. Could you give us a recap and where you think we might go?
Sure. And thanks very much, Steve. Thank you to Jimson and to the others who've given us to Cheryl for comments. Basically, the idea is that they would look that the report looked at the current setup of geography and what our options were. ICANN has a kind of unique system that they use that developed over the course of time. They evaluated whether or not it made sense to change that to be more in keeping with the UN or some other geographic setup. The recommendation that they make is that would not be necessarily beneficial to the community in that it doesn't get us anything new and might cost some extra money, and I think that probably makes good sense. There was also a discussion about whether or not gender should be added to this as part of the diversity, because everyone agrees that geographical diversity is important. And I know it's International Women's Day, so I wanted to throw that out. Given that we are in there's a fairly narrow mandate of this particular report looking at geography. And so I wanted to throw it out to the group for conversation. If we wish to try to include gender and potentially other markers of diversity in this, how would we want to do it that wouldn't fall too far outside of the recommendations of the report? So I'd like to open the conversation if people would like to discuss that.
Yeah, we're looking for creativity on how to work that in. Marilyn, go ahead.
So, guys, this is not the first time this topic has come up. In fact, when we met in Brussels, there was quite a heated debate about whether there should be metrics, standards, requirements, et cetera. Women and girls do make up roughly 50% of the world's population. However, I'm a little sensitive about... and I am also taking note of the fact that the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal 5 is about improving gender diversity and gender participation. I'm happy to work with others to have a perhaps laudatory statement, but I'm not. I think we should be aspirational in encouraging mechanisms to increase all forms of diversity, but not to go over the board in any particular kind of diversity, but to be aspirational. In otherwise, we're going to find ourselves setting quotas and arguing about the quotas.
Marilyn and Andy, consider this for a minute. In the text on Geographic, we could make the recommendation that whenever ICANN reports geographical diversity results, that they report the total and the breakdown between men and women. So we would force them to start to report that data in a way that gives visibility on it.
So let me make a very quick comment. In the IGF, I'm going to use it as an example. In the IGF, the Internet Governance Forum, we report on stakeholder group and on gender attendance. We are now, in an adjacent forum, we are now going to require the national and regional IGFs to also gather at registration and report on it. We're not measuring them, but we're reporting on it. And it has already, in only 2 years, begun to make a difference.
We should put in our comment, raise the aspirational aspect of gender diversity in the context of geographical outreach and diversity, and insisted that the data be reported that way.
So
Andrew.
I have a suggestion, Steve, because this report is actually fairly narrow. It says, do we or do we not want to change the geographical categories that we use? And I think we're all in agreement. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I think we're all in agreement that that adds a level of complexity that doesn't necessarily give us anything more as a community. So I'm going to park that idea if everyone's comfortable. Okay. Now, on the second, and so that since there is nothing specifically aimed at gender diversity, but the general idea of diversity, taking Steve's point, why not suggest as part of our aspirational goals that we would like to get, we would like ICANN to be reporting on the percentage of or the number of women that attend each of their meetings, both intersessionals as well as major meetings, so that we are able to track this and to maybe also ask them to track the number of positions that are held by women and to use that as our marker. And so then we're not trying to shoehorn in something that wouldn't necessarily fit with this report, but this is a good opportunity, I think, to do it that way. Does it make sense to everyone?
Yeah, I think that's great. That's creative, Susan.
So I totally agree with that, and I haven't read the report, so but I just think that we, as women especially, have a responsibility to make sure, and especially in ICANN, it's gotten better, but you know, you look around the room, there it's not equal. So, and in the CCT review, it was very clear that, you know, we've got 3 out of 15 women on the CCT review team. That's unacceptable. So, you know, we can expand that statement a little bit to include all review teams, all positions. You know, let's make it as clear without being, and detailed without being too detailed. And the transparency, which I think we need to make. We need to comment on transparency in every comment. Doesn't matter how much it really relates to that comment, but transparency, transparency. So they need to report these.
Transparency coupled with granularity, because if they just give us the total, you haven't learned anything about the breakdown.
Right.
And let's note for the record that the BC members in this room today are 50-50, men and women. 50-50, sure did. Exactly. Count them up. Count them up.
Yes.
12 and 12.
Right, exactly. Okay, well, that's good for us, right? I know that that's not the case across ICANN. Susan, could I ask your help then in kind of going into some of those granularities? Because I think that would be really, really useful. And frankly, it will reflect, I think, positively on the BC that we mentioned, that the group that put this comment together was half women and half men.
Steve, it's Marilyn. I will accept that comment, but I will tell you the count this morning in the CSG was 11 to 27.
Thank you. The BC once again leads the way. Gabby is also on the line, so if I count the Adobe.
She said she supports.
Okay. And Gabby is supporting where we're headed with this. Maria.
Just as an add to that, Marie from AIM, as I was catching the Scribe feed this morning, I'd like you to know that Dennis Mitchell was sitting at the table, according to the Scribe feed. So I think your count is wrong, Marilyn. I think we were one less.
No, darling.
I may have changed it, but you were Dennis Mitchell.
I know the people. I counted their faces.
Gabby?
Can I say something?
Louder, please, if you could.
Okay, so just that sometimes the combination with gender issues and geographical issues also affect a lot. In my case, I could only participate in ICANN meetings with financial support from ICANN, and when I have a baby, then it becomes impossible for me to participate during the whole year in which I have to travel with my baby, unless I travel with someone else. Just what Kieran said about nannies and all of that, there's no support for that. I understand maybe it's too much to ask that from ICANN, but when you have this combination, being from a developing world and a woman, then I think the challenges are higher. So just wanted to, even though we are half and half, now I can't be there. So and Kieran was able to travel with her baby because it's different. She has a different kind of support from her company. So the combination also affects a lot. Just wanted to make clear that point.
Thank you. Before we move to council, Susan and Phil, the policy calendar includes the highlights from the agenda that you have today, and you guys have quite a bit to discuss with us about council. Since CCWG's approval is part of your discussion, I wanted to refer the rest of the BC members. We've already covered it in the BC closed meeting, and we covered it in the CSG this morning. At the very bottom of the policy calendar, I've repeated the reference to the BC having achieved nearly all of the things we asked for in the last round, and I attached that as the third document attachment, at the comparison of the BC's comments in the third draft of CCWG with the final. So at the bottom of that email, I had also included this potential for the BC to support a statement that the NCSG wants to make regarding inviting and urging all ACs and SOs to give us an indication as soon as they can about whether they intend to participate so that we can write the bylaws accordingly. And the bylaws writing window, I learned last night, is far shorter than what we had thought it was. We would basically need to know in the next 4 weeks, or we end up locking in the expectation that five of the ACSOs are going to be participating. So the thresholds are set sometimes as high as four. If we end up losing one of those participants, like, say, the GAC, for instance, or the ASO, if they stepped out, then suddenly we only have four ACs and SOs participating in the empowered community, and the thresholds can't be set at four because we don't ever want to require unanimity. So I set that table for you, and I circulated this last night in an email. We don't really know whether that yellow highlighted text in my email at the bottom of this, we don't really know whether it will get us anything. I personally believe it doesn't cost us anything, because I don't believe it's offensive to the GAC. But this may be a moot point, because unless Susan and Phil in the negotiations with council learn that it gets us another vote, then there isn't really any point in heading down that path. So with that, Marilyn, let's let Susan and Phil walk us through the council part, and when they get the CCWG, if this paragraph becomes essential, because otherwise we probably don't even need to go there. I haven't even heard if it's still alive as an issue. So Susan and Phil, that's it for me. I'll turn it over to you to take care of council.
Well, yeah, I don't have much to add from my comments in the CSG meeting this morning. I still have not seen anything on the council list where any councilors indicated that they want to vote on any of the recommendations or whether they plan to vote no if there's a final vote on the full package. And there would only be a final vote if there's a vote against one of the recommendations. And so, whether it gets us something or not, to me personally, is not the big issue. I think, it ought to, it's not that big an ask to ask an SO or an AC, do you intend to be part of this empowered community? I mean, they've had a long time to think about it. And if a SO or AC at this point in time can't even indicate that, I am personally concerned about their ability to participate in the empowered community in a timely way. So you may have one that said we're going to participate in principle, but in practice is usually unable to participate because they cannot reach a consensus view within any reasonable time frame, given the time limits in the accountability process.
If I could follow up with you on that, I mean, you're so right. The ASO is one of the five. ASO is the address supporting organization. They indicated very early on they wanted to participate, but they're focused on addresses. So suppose the first two or three times we exercise the empowered community over a board spill, a bylaws, or a budget block, the ASO says, you know, this has nothing to do with the numbers, so we're just going to sit this one out. We're going to abstain, and they have every right to do that. If that ends up being a pattern where they said they'd participate and turn out to abstain more often than not, we find ourselves in a position of needing to get unanimity of those who are going to weigh in.
And to continue that thread, if two SOs or ACs are unable or unwilling to participate in a particular accountability process, then you wouldn't even get the, if you had the unanimity among the remaining ones, you still wouldn't reach the threshold you need for the ultimate action. So I defer to you, Steve, on what the report says about that. But it seems to me the bylaws have to say that if an SRAC doesn't participate in a timely way, the thresholds have to come a notch down.
That's not in our report.
I know.
So the bylaws won't say that. But the bylaws will say is that if an AC or SO tells us, thank you, but we're not going to participate anymore, at that point we change the bylaws and we change the thresholds. So the progression would be that if the ASO over the period of a year found itself continually not participating, the community would need to have a conversation about that. Should the ASO step out? They may not want to. In fact, what they may say is that there are seven powers here. There are three of them we want to be part of, and four we don't. We can actually change the thresholds for just the ones that they're not part of. So we can make the thresholds specific to the powers, and I think there's an opportunity there. The statement that's in yellow is not intended to single out any one group. It ends up being felt most acutely by the GAC, who's in a tough position to decide, but it's not meant to be just about the GAC. So we have some hands up on this topic. I guess I could manage the queue for you folks. Aparna?
This is just a question for Susan and Phil, and I think you probably circulated on this on the list, so I apologize. When is the deadline for counselors to weigh in as to whether they want a vote on a particular recommendation?
6 p.m. tonight, and there's a special council meeting from 6 to 7 where that's it. That's the drop-dead time to state whether or not you're going to ask for a vote on any one or more recommendations and whether you intend to vote no on a full package of the 12 recommendations if we have a vote on that. So we'll know by 7 p.m. tonight coming out of that meeting, and we can share that information with BC members.
One follow-up to, do you need to know tonight whether any of the GNSO constituencies intend to have statements accompanying their vote? Is that part of tonight's session?
Has asked for is to be very open and honest. That's what this, we usually have a Tuesday night meeting anyway to go through motions and not be able to say things you wouldn't say when you have an audience. So it's a closed session. And so he is asking for this to be the cutoff. Whether or not we get that or not out of everyone, I don't know.
Maybe this is the question that you're getting at, but I guess in my mind, is there a way to sequence things such that we wait to see if anyone asks for a vote on any particular item, recommendation, I guess is the best way to call them, and then if we sense from that there's trouble, weigh in with this statement that we think the NCSG would find supportive? Or is that not kosher given kind of the way that James has set up the timeline?
I'll bet that would work fine. Yeah. But it may be that it's recommendation 1 and 2 where they would likely bring this up at the NCSG. So we may not be the ones that actually put the statement on the table. It was NCSG. But if they put the statement on the table, I guess what Phil and Susan need to know is that is it all right for the BC to support that statement on the expectation that it might help a bit to get them to a yes with that kind of a statement? And I, for one, and Phil, at least for two, believe that that's appropriate for the BC to do that. Maybe we should go around the room and collect views on that.
This is Chris. I see Gabby has commented in the chat room. Gabby, did you want to say something? It's a little unclear what your comment means.
Be or not want to be a decisional participant. So my question is, if for instance, more ASOs and ACs and AC say no, if this affects in any way the council in the voting, how this
not in council. This is not about council voting. It's about voting in the empowered community, which is the entire cross community. So none of this would affect council voting.
Yes, I know. Okay. So maybe I'm confused. I thought this was related to making more members of the council vote in favor of the whole package.
So you do have it right then. Yeah, you do have it right. And this arose because of the non-commercial stakeholder group who initially was very concerned about the GAC participating and thought this was, in some sense, a way to pressure them. On the other hand, there are many of us who are fine with the GAC being in the community, in the empowered community, completely fine with that. But we understand that these thresholds can't be artificially high, or we'll never be able to get the empowered community to do anything. So we have a general view that it would be better to know sooner than later, and certainly in the next 4 weeks because we're writing the bylaws. So that's the point that Phil and I have been made many times, is that if we can get that certainty, it's beneficial to more than just the NCSG. And certainty for us, frankly, would be the GAC saying, yes, we'd like to be part of the decisional community. It's not an effort to force them to say no. And Marilyn has her hand up.
It's Marilyn. I need to report the conversation that I had with the this transcript is public, right? With a member of the European Nordic government and with a member of the ELAC government separately about this issue. Both of them, so think you have a Nordic country from Europe, and you have an ELAC country from Latin America. Both of them report that it is very, very difficult for some governments. There was also, by the way, in the conversation, a representative of an Asian government. Both report that it is very, very difficult for them to commit to that they will know whether they can participate in that role because the issue might change. The issue might... I understand what you're saying to me. I'm explaining to you what they said, that some governments are required to come empowered to make a decision on the spot, and other governments are required to go back and take consultation. So actually, Steve, I think what they're still saying, what I'm hearing from my consultation with them, is it's very hard for the GAC as a whole to predict today. And that's what we're asking them to do.
Yeah, let me clarify. That's not it at all. We're asking them to say, when we write the bylaws next month, should we count you among the five AC and SOs generally who intend to participate? And that doesn't mean that you must vote in all cases. On any given issue, a year from today, we have a bylaw coming up for approval. And the GAC gets together and says, you know, we're going to attend the meeting, we'll attend the forum, but we'd prefer not to oppose or support, and we're going to abstain, or we're just going to advise. On any given issue, they can support, oppose, abstain, or advise. So this isn't about the issues down the road. This is about a general point of entry that has to be known in the bylaws in the next 4 weeks. And that's why I see that as a distinction. And that question has been in front of the GAC for 14 months.
Yeah, Steve, I just to better inform this conversation, I just looked again at the proposed process for how the council is going to deal with this, which is now No one's objected, so it is the process. The deadline tonight is just to declare whether you're going to ask for a vote on any recommendation, and then James is asked and no one has objected if anyone thinks they're going to vote no on all the package, if we have a vote on that. The deadline for, we will not necessarily know what statements will be submitted tonight because the deadline for submitting, let me just get down here. The deadline for any written statements to be received from parts of the GNSO is by the close of tomorrow's public GNSO council meeting, or if it runs really long, which I don't think it will, by no later than 1800 UTC tomorrow. So we may not necessarily know all or even any of the statements that are intended to be submitted by councilors this evening. It will be tomorrow.
Thanks for that clarification, Phil. So ordinarily, things happen on the fly in council. There'll be negotiations by email all night long. You guys will be confronted with a situation. And when it comes up, if it comes up, and the NCSG is suggesting that a statement like that, if it had broader support in the GNSO, would get them to a yes, what I'd like to do is to give you the discretion. This is just me personally. Give you the discretion to know that whether the membership would support you agreeing to the statement if you thought, in the moment, you thought it would help make a difference. And we owe you that, to tell you yes or no. And I think Marilyn's expressed a concern that we shouldn't. A couple of us believe we should. I guess we should figure that out right here and now to know whether you have the discretion to agree to that statement. So how would you like to poll?
Can I comment?
Oh, Cabby, I'm sorry. Your hand is up. Go ahead.
I'm not sure if we are able to draft any possible amendments to this text, but maybe when you just talked about what is expected from the GAG, that it's not to say that they will participate in everything. And then it says here, urge all ACs and SOs to publicly announce their intention to participate or not participate. And maybe someone that has better English than me can change that in order to make it a little bit more soft, in the sense that here it says say yes or no, and that's not really the purpose, because just explain that to participate doesn't mean that they have to participate in every issue and in every single decision. So I'm not sure if there's any room to drafting, but maybe there's a chance there to make it a little bit more soft in terms of the commitment that they have to, if they say yes, I mean the GAG. I'm not sure if this is helpful.
Thank you, Gabby. This was text that was worked on Sunday, and I'm certain that it will be different when it gets in front of Susan and Phil. So even if we in the BC were to wordsmith this and make it somewhat clearer, there's no expectation that those would be the words Phil and Susan would confront in the middle of a council meeting tomorrow, because you've been a counselor, Gabby, and you know what a moving target that is.
Yeah.
There are, as Marilyn said, there are undoubtedly some GAC members who don't appreciate the difference between saying we are in the bylaws today versus participating every time a decision comes to the Empower community. There's definitely, and I acknowledge that misunderstanding, and we can try to clear that misunderstanding up in this statement, but the GAC's not going to be in the room. They're not going to be part of that, and I have a hard time believing they'll ever even read these statements that are coming out at the end of the day tomorrow. So we may be spending too much time on what could end up being insignificant, but if it could contribute to getting the NCSG to help support this proposal, that's significant enough to burn another few minutes of discussion. So is there anyone who would object to giving Phil and Susan the discretion? Anyone here that would object to giving Phil and Susan the discretion to agree to a statement of this nature if they thought it would be helpful in the negotiation and voting tomorrow? Look for a show of hands and then comments. I see two.
And Steve,
how many objections?
Just to clarify.
Can I go ahead? I just wanted some clarification. You did inform that this issue has been before GAC for 18 months. So what is their feel about being part of the decision?
There are some confusion. There's an inherent difficulty of the GAC to come up with a yes or no on anything. And UK government, for instance, said we'd rather not be in the decision process. So if any one government decides to say, no, I don't want us to commit to be in the empowered community, that would block them from the ability to say that. It's one of the reasons. When we designed this, we said to each of the ACs and SOs, you're invited in and you're considered in unless you say no. You with me on that? And the GAC, because of their difficulty to make a decision that's unanimous, has neither said, no, we don't want to be in, or yes, we do want to be in. And this paragraph encourages, if they can, to give us a decision. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Phil and then Marilyn.
Yeah, and just to clarify my understanding, we're not talking about the BC proposing this. We're talking about whether we have discretion to accept it in a fast-moving dialogue within the council.
Definitely.
Correct?
It's your ability to react if you think it'll help to move the ball. We would not be the proposer. Because I don't believe, given how closely the final proposal tracks to what the BC asked for, I don't believe we had any need to make any statement. We were going to vote yes on all 12 or the package, and we don't need a statement unless agreeing to someone else's statement will end up getting a better result.
And again, to further clarify, that the current statement is not GAC-specific. It's general, and it's not a demand. It's just an encouragement.
Marilyn?
You asked for a show of hands, and I object, but I do not object to being the minority.
Thank you. Any other? All right, so we'll consider that you guys have, you're empowered to do what you see fit along the general contours of that text. And then Susan and Phil, if there's anything else on CCWG, you can move into the rest of the council agenda.
Do you have anything else on CCWG, Susan?
Yes.
Let me bring you up to speed on the RPMs, because I was part of the subgroup. Susan was, but she was away the 1 week that we worked on that, though she was kept apprised by email. At the last council meeting, we passed the motion to establish the working group for the review of all RPMs and all GTLDs, but we did not vote on the charter because some of the NCSG members think for some reason that the UDRP review should precede the RPM review, which to me makes no sense, but that's, I respect the difference. But their rationale was that, well, the staff only laid out three options in the preliminary issues report that we commented on. We suggested something else, and we should basically delegate the decision of what to address and how to proceed to the working group because people should have a right to suggest other options besides the one that staff put out there. I would note for the record that the what's in the current charter, which is RPMs first and UDRP later, received the most support. I don't know if it was most of the comments supported that approach and not other approaches. At the last council meeting, there volunteers were requested to work in a subgroup to see if this could be worked out for the vote tomorrow. And in the course of that subgroup's discussions, it was pointed out that the NCSG wasn't the only one that suggested something that wasn't in the three options, that WIPO and INTA had suggested that the UDRP should not be reviewed at all, and if there was going to be decisional delegation of the working group, it should be free to adopt anything that was proposed by anyone who commented rather than, well, you can adopt the NCHC suggestion, but the WIPO INTA one is off the table. And Amar Elsadir, who was the NCSG rep in that subgroup, agreed that that was the fair and logical way to proceed. Now, I do not know, and I asked Ed Marsh yesterday, and he didn't know of any. I don't know that an actual amendment to this charter will be offered after all of this. I would point out that, number one, the approach that's in the charter is the one that coincides with the BC's public comment on this. It's the only one that makes sense in terms of coordinating the initial work of this working group with the parallel working group on new round subsequent procedures. And it's the only one that assures that at some point there will be a review, not necessarily any change in substance or procedure, but at least a review of the UDRP, which is the only consensus policy that's never been reviewed. I'd also point out that the BC has been on record for several years as wanting at least one procedural change in the UDRP, which is the establishment of standard agreements with the providers, so to assure some consistency and predictability in UDRP decisions as there are more and more providers accredited around the world. So let's see what happens tomorrow, but I think that, I don't know if an amendment will be offered, but I intend to speak for the charter tomorrow. I think it's a good charter. It's consistent with the BC position. It's the right way to go, and if there's an amendment offered, I'll speak against it because I think, and there's been strong support in the BC, that the council should set the priorities for these working groups, and we shouldn't, we don't know who's going to volunteer to be on these working groups, and after it kind of undercuts the entire public comment process to have comments and to see a majority for going a particular way, and then to say even though that was a result of the public comment period, we're not going to make a decision and just basically reopen all the questions for the working group to decide. Any questions or comments on any of that?
I support the plan. I think it makes complete sense. Stick with it.
And then we can move on to the implementing recommendations from the GNSO review. We probably won't vote on that. That'll be deferred because we just haven't had time to review the document. But Chuck Gomes, who's, I think, chairing the working party, did do a presentation to GNSO and showed us the three recommendations they are saying should not be implemented. He sort of has highlighted things between green, orange, yellow, and red. One of those was restructuring of the GNSO to give the commercial stakeholder group to solve the challenges that we see with the commercial stakeholder group, and especially what Wolf was talking about today with the board. So, that was a flat out and out, should not be done. I'm not sure that we agree with that, and so that we will want some input on that. The other two, and unfortunately I can't even find the document right now, but so there's another one that I didn't agree either. I thought it could be reworded a little bit, and they said it was just so unclear they didn't understand the recommendation. I think you could reword the recommendation and make it worthwhile, and the third one I can't remember at all. But so we'll be working on that for the next meeting.
Actually, real quick, this is Chris. Because it brings up a question. Currently, the BC has no representatives on the GNSO review working team because the previous two individuals have both since left the BC. I put out a call, sort of an APB, if you will, to the membership of the BC to see if we can get at least one, ideally two, BC members to participate because we should have some participation there. And so I'm just saying that because I'm sort of reminding people again that this is something you should think about doing if you can, because important work is being done and we don't have a voice right now on that working team. So I just wanted to remind people of that notion.
So could you remind me what happens? So the working group comes up with proposals or suggestions. Do they go to the council for approval, or what's the process for this implementation of the review? Does anyone know?
Susan Kawaguchi for the record. So these all came out of the review.
Right.
And so, yes, so they are taking all those recommendations, coming to us, and there will be a motion, and whether or not to implement and how, and in some ways, have indicated the green highlighted ones, let's just go through with those and on to the red and not implement. So if we agreed with the working parties, recommendation of the review recommendations, then the motion would, you know, move forward to implement in that manner and right. not implement those three.
Right. So this is Denise Michelle. So does the council have the ability to send the proposal back to the working group and ask them to reconsider, or does the council have the option of changing the proposal and then approving it?
I was under the impression, and Phil, correct me if I'm wrong, that we would definitely have the option to say, no, we do think this should be implemented and it should not be highlighted in red, and B, that if a recommendation is not clear enough, that we should provide clarity.
So this is Chris. I'm just clarifying. I guess there is still currency to having people on the working party review too. I just want to clarify that that's notwithstanding the fact that recommendations have been given to the GNSO Council. Good. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Susan John Berard in the chat asks, did Wolf Ulrich say to the board, what did Wolf Ulrich say to the board this morning? I'm not sure.
He was basically asking for reorganization because, you know, the CSG is a sort of a, was foisted upon us and the non-contracted party house situation. So he wants that reviewed and changes made to the GNSO structure.
Errol?
You know, just to be really clear, so what Wolf was reporting on is what was presented at the intersessional that we talked about yesterday. And if you haven't read the summary that Cheryl, if you want a quick summary of it, Cheryl wrote an excellent summary of the intersessional. There are copies here, and the first paragraph summarizes that. He was clarifying, right, what the ISPs are calling for. But, right, Susan, that's what, he was also making it clear that he thinks that the work needs to start with us, not be driven by the staff or the board.
Yeah.
Could just real quickly, and the thing that the birds of feather thing that is on the schedule, that it turns out that is a Rinalia initiative on her own, which is has implications, but it's being driven by other perhaps top-down restructuring interests.
Item 7 on the GNSO agenda is a discussion of RDAP, not a vote, not a motion, but a discussion of RDAP. And you recall that we've covered it not only this morning, but also this afternoon, this notion of the interplay between the RDAP implementation and that of Thick Who Is. It's 15 minutes on the schedule. But please, Phil and Susan, would you use it that time if this comes up tomorrow afternoon, use the time to probe about why the prioritization was RDAP before Thick Who Is, because this description on the agenda for council indicates that we did have a working party that suggested they be synchronized, but synchronization doesn't necessarily mean which one goes first, right? So you can probe a little bit about that and maybe get some answers that will help clarify the way we modify our position.
Any more GNSO review discussion? We all good? Okay. Thank you all. We'll turn back to, if we can put the agenda back up, Chantel, on the screen. And once again, thank you, Chantel, for doing this remotely, notwithstanding all the 8-hour difference for you. It's much appreciated. So I have, this is Chris speaking, I have included some items on the agenda, you'll see. These are topics that we've noodled, if you will, whether on previous calls or in some cases intersessional, and thought it'd be healthy if you just for to make sure we've fully discussed them, included them on this agenda. We may not need any time or limited time if we want to discuss these things, but because we're all together here, it may be worth going into. So, as you see, the first item there is a GNSO reform, which we sort of already been discussing a little bit. And then I know Marilyn, you had raised the notion of board election reform, for lack of a better term. certainly at the intersessional. So perhaps, since I think we've sort of covered GNSO reform a little bit, but I'm happy to, if people want to talk more about that, we can do that. But since we've just had a little bit of discussion about that, maybe we want to just talk a little bit about your thoughts on board election reform, and then if people have other questions and concerns, we can go in.
So, thank you. Marilyn Cade speaking. So when we founded ICANN, we had a board of 10. They were appointed. Officially, the word is that they were selected by John Postel. There was an extensive review process. Over about 300 bios were reviewed by a team of people, some of whom you might know. And Esther Dyson was recruited as the board chair. Mike Roberts was recruited as the first CEO. We always intended to add 5 more board members in an election process. We did hold an election process. There were problems in the election process, and with that model for a lot of reasons. And subsequently, the approach was taken to use a nominating committee. At that point, only 5 members of the board were appointed by the nominating committee process. The majority of the board was elected. We agreed when we set ICANN up to give the We debated intensely the question of giving the CEO the title of CEO and president, or only the title of president, and we made the decision at the time to give Mike Roberts the title of CEO / president and a voting role on the board because he was taking so many risks in helping to set ICANN up for staff members, his personal credit card, and a $1.3 million line of credit, okay? But we never really intended that that it would be a real CEO position. So I give you that as background. At that point, we had the PSO, the ASO, and the GNSO, and the CCNSO that were all electing board members. So the majority of the board was elected. At one point, over my objection, the majority shifted. I should say over my advice, the majority shifted, and now we select the majority of the board. The approach of removing the PSO as full board members and going to the liaison process was led by Crocker and Vince Cerf for a variety of their own reasons. So we now have 5 liaisons who are treated by Crocker as though they are full board members, but they have no accountability to, and as you saw today in the meeting we were just in, bizarrely, the official liaison representative from the SAC chose to take his official board hat off and act as an advocate for his company's individual position. So my proposal is that we look hard at returning to electing the majority of the board so that we have a closer tie between the majority of the board to the community, which would perhaps put 3 seats to be elected by each of the existing SOs, select only 5 of the board, and change the role of the technical liaisons so that they are not treated as full board members, and change the title of the CEO to president and remove the president as a voting board member. Kathy Brown, who is the executive director of ISOC, is a member of the board of ISOC in a non-voting status. It is customary in organizations that are more like ICANN, that is, they're not really commercial, they're more standard-setting policy bodies, that the lead official is not a voting member of the board. By the way, I've looked into how we could make those changes. We could do it in 2 ways. We could do it through approaching these changes through the upcoming ATRT, or we could pursue instantiating a second board review. The board is not required by the bylaws to undergo review, as are the other structures of ICANN, such as the GNSO, etc. The board agreed, after pressure, to accept a board review, which took place between 2009 with implementations in 2012.
Thank you, Marilyn. And I, so this is Chris. I have a question. Maybe this is for Steve, and this is not, this doesn't presuppose agreement or disagreement, but does changing how the board of directors is elected or created, et cetera, impact the accountability proposals? Does it, is there any sort of, no, there's no coordination that would be, I mean.
You know, I don't think so, because the empowered community was based on what the bylaws said are the ACs and SOs. So liaisons and so on who happen also to have a board seat are not mentioned. For instance, the IETF isn't part of the empowered community. So I don't think it would affect it.
I'm thinking actually more, maybe more explicitly in terms of, you know, board removal, for that matter, and whether and the dynamics between removing the board or removing an individual director. Okay.
There couldn't be, because the board members, once they're appointed, the technical liaisons, it is Crocker who chooses to treat them during the meetings as though they are. So he even does straw polls on how they would vote if they had a vote. They have no vote. So that's a treatment decision, and that didn't always exist. The previous chair of the board, Peter Dengate Thrush, did not treat them that way.
And this is Chris again. This may be more my learning curve on this, but I seem to recall in the accountability discussion there was a lot of back, and this may be resolved now, but back and forth about the notion of who sort of has ownership of that board member. And I don't know if this, in terms of not who's nominated, et cetera. So I don't know if the current process is baked into the thinking of, and this may have been even pre, this may have been more early in the stage of the ECWG, and maybe things have changed now with the new model. But I could be going off a tangent here, but there's something I just thought, you know, if it's fine, it's fine. That's,
yeah, it's a fair question, but the only board members that we seek to spill in a spill the board power are the voting members of the board, delineated in the bylaws as voting members. There hasn't been any, and that includes NOMCOM, by the way. They would be spilled as well. But there isn't any discussion of the liaisons. I looked for the word liaison. It's not even in the main report. I'll check the annexes, too. But it's a great question, but I don't think that it would affect, for instance, if we did bylaws changes pursuant to changing the number of seats that come from the ACs and SOs, I don't believe that has any effect on the accountability proposal. If we added or deleted an AC or SO with a voting board seat, that would affect the proposal, and we'd have to adjust the size of the empowered community.
Other thoughts on this notion? Yeah, Steve.
You don't mind one. Marilyn, as the conversation keeps going, and you've had this conversation for a decade, if, in fact, GNSO were to move from having two board members to something more than that, at least under our current structure, four would be a heck of a lot better than three, because then you'd have registries, registrars, commercial stakeholders group, and on, which is better than what we do today, is trying to find a mutually acceptable non-contract party house board member. But so is there any magic to three, or could we begin to say four, even if only aspirational?
So I've done a number of constructs on this, and you're right, I have been thinking about it for a decade. So there's a couple of ways to look at it. You could say, and by the way, I could also give you an analysis of where the board members have come from through the nominating committee over the last 7 years, if you individually want to see me offline. If you could say that the ALAC could elect three, could elect two. Wait, don't they? So you could have the split shifting to have the ALAC elect rather than having four. I actually think three is a good number, and I understand it may be very difficult to elect, but you could continue that each house elects one, and then there is a member who is elected from the entirety of, and I think moving to the bylaws are clear. Once you are appointed as a board member, you know, you're not owned by the community that sent you. But look, here's what we know. Bruce knows a lot more about what is going on at ICANN because he comes from one of the contracted party communities. Marcus is trying as hard as he can to learn more and more about our concerns. What we know about the nominating committee appointees is they are very often rudderless. They don't have trusted people to go to for advice. It's not a question of owning them. It's a question of having expert advisors that they can turn to.
So maybe, this is Chris, maybe Marilyn, assuming that there's interest among the membership in pursuing this further, maybe it would be helpful to for you to sort of put down on paper what you think is a good course of action. And I mean, I think the ultimate threshold question for me is always is this, presumably, and I think it will, benefit the BC by talking more about this and fixing it, and that I think would be helpful in sort of explaining maybe why this is in our interest to think about this some more. And so we can talk about it at future calls and meetings and continue to sort of the dialogue on that. That's I think would be helpful. So it's good you sort of kicked it off now, and maybe we can go on.
It's Marilyn. I'd like to make a final comment. In a casual, informal conversation with a couple of folks from the ISPs at lunchtime and separately with the IPC, another issue came up. It's not an issue. Another possibility came up. If you ratchet back a few years, we did upon occasion hold a one-day intersessional meeting of our own that we organized ourselves within the constituencies, the three constituencies, to work on certain issues that were of interest to us. The one that comes to my mind at this point, back in 2002 through 2004, was cyber squatting. Perhaps at the end of this meeting, we could think a little bit about whether it would be in our interest to plan in the next year ahead to look at topics like this, which are structural. They're not policy, they are structural, and think about a intersessional discussion that we would work on that would help us perhaps in building unanimity or consistency with our colleagues, but not to wait for the ICANN staff to convene an intersessional, to pick something that is important to us and work on it.
Thank you, Marilyn. That's a good suggestion. Further thoughts on this? Okay. Well, now let's go ahead and then move on to the next item, which is, as you see, there's RCEP data gathering. I think we've carved out a few minutes here. We've had obviously email discussion about it leading up to Marrakesh. For those that were at the CSG board roundtable, this is our main topic of discussion with the board. Maybe Denise, if you want to just provide, for those that may not have been there, I think there's some people here that weren't there, but maybe just get a sense of what the board. I think they were generally, at least Bruce seemed to be generally accepting of it. I know Steve sort of said, you know, hey, come back to can you come back to us with some more, or. Yeah, what exactly? Some more feedback that they can work off of. So maybe you give a sense of where you think, get people a sense of where the board, at least the board members that were there, thought about it, and then and we can talk more if you want.
I think the board member from Afilias was concerned about what we would do if given data on the RCEP, but I think generally the board members who were engaged seemed to agree that basic data gathering and analysis of a program that's 10 years old and has never been assessed is appropriate. So I'll simply take the email that I shared with the list on this topic, rewrite it a little bit, and send that off to Steve and Bruce so they have a record of it. I'm optimistic that something will be done.
Any other thoughts, questions on that issue? Marilyn?
Yes, I want to go back. It's Marilyn. I want to go back to the comment I made because I am very concerned about what happened this morning. And so let me explain to you what I saw that happened this morning. I'll go into my larger concern about it later. What happened, in my view, is a liaison from the ESSAC, who is the official liaison from the ESSAC, who is charged with acting only on the board, as the liaison from the SAC and is charged, like other board members, when he has a conflict, to totally recuse himself from even commenting on a topic, went to the microphone, took off his technical liaison hat, and said he was with a Phileas, said he was with a registry, and began to ask questions and advocate about concerns that his company has. That, to me, is a significant conflict of interest. And I have real concerns about it. And I would like us to think about expressing informally some concerns about him.
This is Denise Michelle. I was being a bit facetious. I wouldn't support making an issue of Rahm's questions about what our hypothesis are about RCEP and what we would do with the data. I think it would be appropriate simply to restate our very basic request and hope that they fulfill it and then move on. I would prefer to keep this issue separate from issue of board members' conflicts of interest or the board's structure at this point.
So we have, you know, it's a fair issue to raise, Marilyn. Let's maybe table that for the moment. But it's a fair point.
Because I'm perfectly happy to have it tabled. I just wanted to explain to the members why it was of concern to me. Yep. But I respect the decision.
Yep. No, thank you. Okay. Well, I mean, anything else you want to add? Okay. So we'll await the board's response and get a better sense of where they want to go with this. But we'll continue to pursue it with them. Wonderful. Well, let's move on to the next item. BC Charter discussion and update. I know we've got two members from the charter team here, Phil and Andrew. I know Andy and Steve Coates can't participate right now. So maybe Phil, could you provide a little insight? I think we're getting down to the end. I believe of the review of the charter.
I am delighted to report that after a seemingly endless number of 1-hour calls every Tuesday at noon Eastern time, we have completed the draft chart. I don't know if Chantel has conveyed that for your review. The only step left is to complete the application form for admission to the BC, which is being changed into not just an application form, but a status form in which BC members can update changes in their company and other things. So it will be not just a form for application purposes, but for kind of a statement of interest for BC members. In going through the former charter, and no aspersions on anyone involved with the former charter, but it just a great deal of it was ambiguous, had a lot of subjectivity, left a lot of room for subjective judgments, seemed to mandate procedures that are not the way the BC actually operates. So we're basically proposing for your consideration a charter which is in form and structure is quite similar to the existing charter, but in substance is pretty much a brand new document. And I don't think we should get into the details. That's going to require detailed review by all the BC members, and then we can, on one of our regular calls or on a special call, the drafting team can take questions about why did you do this and what does that imply. But it's been really lawyered to where we had long discussions, sometimes 30 minutes, on whether a particular word was appropriate and if it was confusing and whether we should have another one. So we've really tried to make it as tight and as clear as possible and to reflect the manner in which the BC actually operates today. There's a couple of issues left for BC consideration. We didn't get into whether the weighted voting for the different categories of members, whether we should still have separate weights of different categories and what the we thought that was something the whole constituency should decide. Another issue with which we struggled over several calls and finally gave up is that we there is in the, not in our charter, but in the GNSO charter, there's language that no entity should be a voting member of more than one stakeholder group or constituency simultaneously. And really, what does that – we got into, well, can you vote in the BC this week? And, you know, let's say if you're operating a new TLD registry and you have non-voting status in the registry stakeholder group, but they're dealing with a very important question to you, can you next week switch to become a voting member of them and then switch back to us? And we tried to set time periods, and we just gave up. We thought that this is something the whole constituency should think about, and it may, and frankly, the bigger question is whether when the GNSO rule was created, we had very separate silos, and there's been a lot more homogenization where different entities have more than one interest within the ICANN structure, and maybe that rule is archaic, or maybe the GNSO should be the one to collectively clarify what that, you know, voting in just one means, and whether you can switch around once every week, once every month, once every year, or not switch at all, whether you're, you know, once you revoke voting status, you're barred from coming back and asserting it again for some set period. Let me see if there's anything else there. There are some significant changes, one of which the current BC, and again it's addressed to this, the current BC charter says that to be a member or to retain membership, you can't derive more than half of your revenue from contracted party activities. In the proposed new charter, that is reduced to 10% to make the BC membership really focused on companies that are, it doesn't mean that if you have registry operations or registrar operations, you can't be a member. It just means they can't be more than a fairly de minimis portion of your overall revenues to maintain BC membership. That's a question the BC, the full BC membership should address, but we did think that 50% was too high. We also addressed the question arose, and I would say Andy Abrams, who was chairing our group for about the past year, was completely on board with this. We addressed the question, well, can a, you know, can separate subsidiaries and affiliates of a large diversified company be separate members of the BC since they are separate corporate entities? And we've changed the charter, so the answer is no. That is, and again, Google was completely on board with this. They agree that Google and its subsidiaries and affiliates should not be able to be separate members because of the basic principle that we don't want any one company being able to have multiple memberships and multiple votes within the same constituency. Those are a few of the highlights. There may be other issues of interest to individual members here on or on the chat room that care about, but it's a very well-considered a revision of the charter, which we hope will be adopted. Of course, the membership is free to address any of the issues raised there and to change it before final adoption, but it's really a lot clearer and a lot tighter, and the separate provisions that relate to each other make a lot more sense now than the current charter, and there's going to be a lot more certainty about what our charter means and how it should be interpreted compared to the current document. And I'll stop there and see if there's any questions.
Andrew, did you want to add anything to Phil's report?
No, I mean, I think the point to echo, I think, from Phil's overview is that it is going to need, you know, a separate conversation from the BC, time for everybody to review the charter because the changes are extensive, and a chance for everybody to have probably a devoted meeting just to that to review everything.
And I do want to thank while the current drafting team has been Andy Abrams, Andrew Harris, Stephen Coates and myself, we do list in the final report. A lot of other BC members, current and past, have devoted a considerable amount of time to this process, which has gone on for I think, almost 2 years. So a great deal of effort and energy and thought has gone into this revision.
So I see Steve and then Marilyn.
Thanks, Phil. I haven't read it yet, but when you mentioned the 10% threshold of contract party revenue, I run a trade association, and with the stroke of a pen, several of my members became contract parties because they run dot brand TLDs. So do we have some degree of precision about that revenue, that if they, it's a company who happens also to be a contract party, does that suddenly mean that everything that they do is a contract party? Or do we have something more granular there? Do you understand the nature of the problem?
Yeah, I understand it, Steve. And again, this is, we felt as a drafting team that 49.9% was too high to really differentiate entities that were primarily about business use of the Internet as opposed to those engaged in deriving significant revenues from contracted parties activities. But it was basically set low to clarify the issue, and if the BC collectively wants to go with a higher number, that'll be the collective decision of the membership.
And I wanted to suggest that there's two ways to go. The number is one factor, and the other is the definition. So is Google now a contract party? Is Amazon a contract party? Is Fox a contract party under your definition?
It's based on total revenue, and I don't think, not at this point, I don't know of any, we'd have to look at it, but I don't know of any company that's operating new TLDs that's deriving very significant revenue as a percentage of its total revenue from that activity.
I'm not making it clear. As a trade association?
Yeah.
My members include companies who happen also to be dot brand. And did that suddenly make them a contract party for the purpose of the BC litmus test?
Oh, you're asking whether we're applying that to individual members. So I think in your case, we'd probably be looking at net choice making. I don't have the language in front of me. I forgot to load the document, and then we don't have time to look it up right now. I know it went out. But the question would be, is net choice making more than 10%? Of its revenues from contracted party activities. We're not going down to the next layer and looking at whether some percentage of your membership is involved in that.
Marilyn and then Jimson.
On this question of voting in multiple places, I was looking in the bylaws. At the time we wrote the original charter of the BC, the original charter, which was then updated in 2009 through an open consultation process that was chaired within the BC. We had staff support from ICANN because we had to, due to the other changes and the establishment of the CSG, we had to have a new charter for the BC and a fit into the CSG charter. I just mentioned that. So we had long discussions at that time that included a discussion with ICANN legal staff about the voting in multiple places. I personally do not think that an entity should vote in multiple places. I think they should pick their voting home, and hopefully we will make few enough decisions that are about that are made on policy about voting that it harms anyone. But that's a personal view. But I think we need to, if you haven't had a chance, and I am on the distribution on the list, if we haven't had a chance yet to look at the linkage to the CSG charter, Phil, we just might want to do that and ask for help from Ken Bauer, the support team, on doing that. Because I think the voting in multiple places issue will be harmful to our interest, because I think it will cause public interest concerns with others who have to approve major charter changes for any organization, because the charter change does have to go through a form of public comment.
Yeah, thank you for that background, Marilyn. And just to amplify a bit, again, this is a provision in the BC Charter which is trying to implement something that's in the GNSO and CSG rules. So it's not something that originated with UNCTAD. It's something we're trying to be compliant with. There is language in the proposed new charter in which it says the BC discourages members from switching voting status. I forget the exact word, but basically frequently for strategic purposes. But within our working group, we simply could not reach consensus on what the on going further and imposing some sort of time limit, saying, you know, once you join, you know, you're locked in for a calendar year, or once you leave BC voting status, you can't come back and assert voting status for X amount of time. They're just, we're very divergent views within the working group, the drafting group, and we felt that this was a big question that the full BC membership should address.
This is Andrew, and just for absolute clarity, the revised charter does not allow multiple voting in multiple constituencies or stakeholder groups. It does not allow that. And also, in your point on Ken Bauer, he was I wasn't involved from the start of this process, but my understanding is that he was all along checking this very closely on the CSG and GNSO charters. So that was part of the process.
In this discussion, I think we should also extend thanks to Ken, who was a huge resource and did excellent work on our behalf, and was really every time we asked him to do some technical research or redraft something along these lines, by the next week the research had been done and the changes had been made. He really I commend. He's one of the best ICANN staff people I've ever worked with.
Okay, Jimson speaking. Well, I also want to appreciate the committee for the enormous time they devoted to this. First, I have a comment and then about three questions. On the voting issue, I think it would be ideal before election takes place that members can declare that they want to be a voting member or non-voting member. So that for that calendar year, as you said, to be quite clear, so at the beginning, right at the beginning. And then the questions, I checked through the draft. I did not see anything about the outreach committee or the possibility of the BC, based on need, appointing another committee down the line. So the charter captured the ESCOM, the finance committee, but the outreach committee is missing. And then
which one is missing?
Outreach committee. There's no mention of outreach committee that the BC set up last year. You know, we have the criteria and all those details. If you need them, I could send them to you so you look at it. Then we maybe after this agenda, we'll be talking about general counsel, provision, indemnity. So just to also flag that there could be a placement for that. We need to capture that in the charter. So do you have a consideration for that? And the question, how long will it take for the charter to be approved by the board in view of the general counsel role? You know, if we go ahead with the language for the general counsel, we will need to have that in the charter so that it can readily go ahead with this engagement with all the deliverables we want from him. So just for projection, I want to know how long it could take. So assuming that BC approved today the charter from this house, so following the processes, how long will it take?
Let me do a quick response and let others weigh in. The outreach committee, if that's an official standing committee and we just missed it, and that's why we have full constituency review to see if we missed anything or if people are uncomfortable with anything there. Plus, we have other things when we need member input. On the general counsel, we have a placeholder. We knew that something would be coming, but since the XCOM hasn't decided on exact language yet, we couldn't put the language in there as a drafting committee. So far as BC review, we're going to have to, you know, everyone's been very busy on accountability, but the charter's done, and I think we should give members a decent amount of time to review it because it's a lot of detail in there. And then either devote one of our regular calls to a discussion or set up a special call for a discussion before we can go further with it.
Marilyn and then Cheryl.
And did you get clarification? It's Marilyn speaking. Did you get clarification about the need for other public comment other than approval by the VC, review by the legal staff? Is there a requirement in for in a change in a charter for external public comment? I thought there was. I just wanted to mention that because it will take, that's an additional 30 to 45 days.
Marilyn, this is Andrew. I'm sorry. I kind of understand what you just said, but can you clarify? Do you mean that when they finish up the draft charter that they throw it out to the public, or just to BC members who are not here?
Marilyn speaking. So guys, gosh, I've become the resident historian here. The use of charters to establish a constituency, there's a procedure that had to be agreed to within the GNSO. And then when the houses were created, there were modifications. So just for some of you, you were around when the very, very acrimonious effort to establish a non-commercial organization constituency the first time, which was killed by the NCUC. The subsequent effort, now called the NPOC, was a very different approach than what they originally wanted. And the NCUC very effectively used the public comment process to force changes. I believe there is a requirement for a public comment opportunity from the broader community because the nature and structure of a constituency, you know, it could significantly impact the representation more broadly within the GNSO. That's why I was wondering if that had been checked on, because the registries modified their charter at one point, and I'm fairly sure it was put out for public comment.
Yeah, I see Denise nodding her head. And you have, I believe,
yes,
there may
the
be a need
yes.
for public comment. And
the answer is yes.
She's public confirming
comment,
it.
Which is why you guys are looking at public comments for the registry charter. All charters have to go out for public comment.
And this is Chris. So just the public comment period begins post board review acceptance, or before the board considers it. Okay.
Yeah. Having said, I can't think of anything in the proposed new charter that would, you know, raise a great outcry from the general public. But who knows? You never know what's going to pop up. But there's nothing I can think of that other members of the ICANN community or the broader public would. Seize on if, you know, and object to.
Cheryl.
Just a quick point of clarification. Apologize about my voice. So you said that you have to hold a vote in one constituency, but is there any move to change whether or not an organization can belong to multiple constituencies? And what is the rule with respect to an individual? Does it have to be different individuals, or can the same individual attend meetings? You know, are there any rules with respect
to
that?
No, there's no rule against any entity, trade association, company, whatever, being members of more than one stakeholder group or constituency. The rule is that you can't vote in more than one. But when you really say, well, what does that mean? If I vote in BC Tuesday, can I, you know, on Tuesday midnight, can I declare myself a non-voting member and vote in a different group I belong to the next day? That's the issue that we struggled with and could not reach consensus on. But we don't change that in any way. And the existing charter just says that, you know, you have to declare where. And so far as representation, we keep the current rule that if an entity is represented by an individual in another ICANN constituent stakeholder group, they need a different individual representing them in the BC.
Merrill.
I just want to offer one more point on that and reinforce how important that last point is. I know some of you may find it somewhat burdensome to have multiple people involved, but just remember that we have fought very hard to have unique identification within the in the eyes of the board and the staff. And if we don't maintain that unique structural representation, then I think we're going to find ourselves back in that battle with the board and the staff on being homogenized under the CSG instead of having the unique recognition that we're, I think, winning back.
This is Chris. Okay, so I think, any further comments, I guess, on what Phil and Andrew have said? So I agree that we should have, I think we should have a separate call just on this. This is a pretty heavy lift, 2 years in the making and many, many man hours. Scheduling TBD, but I think that ideally I would have, you know, we give the charter, send the charter out, the new charter out to the membership with at least 2 weeks time before any call to give people a chance to really do a thorough analysis. That said, I also think that considering that we have a public comment period that's going to have to take place and we're going to have to wait on the board to make a decision, I think the desire would be that we want to get this out done sooner rather than later, that, you know, my goal would be try to have a call on this, you know, within the next 4 to 6 weeks at the latest, and you know, working on people's schedules and so forth. But, and maybe that we substitute the time, you know, instead of one BC call, we just do this call instead. But that's my thought process. Phil?
Yeah, I agree. And Chantel has confirmed in the chat room that we have not distributed to yet. We didn't want to dump another big document on you right before this meeting because we're not going to decide it here. But I think we should. Next week we can get it out to everybody and give you maybe 2 weeks to look it over. I think you'll find it's a very tightly written document and very comprehensive. And then we can schedule a call where we can all talk about it, and I think it would be good to have people submit questions and requests for clarifications in advance of that call so we can have a really good agenda for the call and address every question and concern that BC members may raise.
And I also would suggest that, as you've done today, flagging those issues that are outstanding, you know, topics of interest that we know we're going to have to talk about, from your point of view, and then there may be others that people will find as they read the document. But certainly, the ones we know already off the top of the shelf, we can list those and get those started. Jimson, Jim.
Yeah, just to offer that perhaps we can append those outreach stuff. Yeah, I will send the details to you.
Okay.
So that that will be out of it, and if we're through with the general counsel language, then that could be tidied up too.
Great. Okay. Well, let's move right along. Chantel, could you put up the we're going to talk about the general counsel hire indemnity clause issue real quick. Could you put that language up? And while she's doing that, why don't I just give a lay of the land? So I think this issue was first brought to the BC's attention, I think, at least in Dublin. Maybe was it before? Maybe even before Dublin. But I know we had a discussion about this in Dublin. Just to summarize, the BC, in order to effectuate, certainly to effectuate payment of membership dues, we need to set up an employer identification number, incorporate ourselves as a nonprofit in District of Columbia, and do some various other legal operations to be able to do that. In order to do that, we would need to get a general counsel that we would hire to, frankly, use his or her firm's EIN for our disposal. He would receive. You can see sort of some of the items there listed. What they would do, some of them administrative, some of them legal, and serve as the go between us. He also helped file any tax returns we may have. we had hoped, we'd been doing some due diligence since Dublin, we thought maybe we could find a way, because the IPC has their own EIN but yet doesn't have a general counsel, that we could sort of mimic what they've done. But it turns out that they received their EIN prior to 9/11. And so post 9/11, we're a different world now. So what was available to them is not available to us. So bottom line is, we do need to pursue the notion of a general counsel. And through Jimson's hard work, we have a firm lined up. The question is just, they've provided us an indemnity clause, which is perfectly understandable. So the question before us is whether we can come to, you know, get a functioning indemnity clause that we can then, from at least, you know, give to the attorney, and he or she can then work on it. But we're calling us. What I've done is above, and this is, we've also had this conversation, I think, a little bit on a prior BC call. I know Merrill made a good suggestion about perhaps delineating the duties that the GC would be undertaking, which I've attempted to do above. And to give it to just to put to cabin exactly what this person is meant to do. So one issue is that in the original indemnity clause, it was treated the GC was treated as if he was an officer or even a member of the executive committee, if you will, but then not have any voting power or so forth. So I've tried to make clear that he has to be, I guess, quote unquote, an officer of the BC in order to for legal purposes, but make it clear that obviously that he or she has no power to vote on matters. That's up to the executive committee. I've listed the delineated duties there. Some of them are one-time things. I still would like to list them there. I think it's just important to do that. If for whatever reason we have to redo something, then it's good to just to have them there. And then I've tried to, I guess, tighten, if you will, the full indemnification clause, in part because, as originally written, it indemnifies all officers of the BC, and I don't know if that's frankly necessary. And so that was how I think it was presented to us by the attorney, and that could just be boilerplate language, frankly. But I think in this case, really, this indemnification clause really should only apply to the general counsel. And so I've tried in many just instances just trying to make it clear that this is this applies just to the general counsel. That's why you see officer crossed out and general counsel replaced. So this is what I've tried to do. I don't expect we come to a conclusion necessarily here today, but and the XCOM itself has to finally sort of also determine what we want to sort of give back, if you will, to our counsel for him to look at. But I thought it'd be helpful to give people a sort of a state of play on this. We are anxious to get it finalized. I know poor Jimson is I think he's lost a few years of his life trying to deal with this. And I'm sympathetic. So if nothing else, I'd like to open it up for comments and thoughts from the membership that we can take back to the XCOM and our deliberation and finalizing this. And, of course, we would go back to the BC on a future call, hopefully in the near future, to run this down. So, Marilyn, quick.
Thank you, Chris. Marilyn Gate. I helped set up an NGO recently. I'm on the board of WAVE, and I am the official treasurer. I am one of the two board members who have legal responsibility. So I tell you that so I can ask this question. Because the general counsel, I am supportive of everything you're doing. Believe me, I go back longer than Jimson does in dealing with this problem. But my question is, is the BC setting up a separate legal entity? And in that case, what under which state are we incorporating? And who are the board members of record? Because you will have to file other forms, believe me, not just tax returns, but a couple of other forms in order to maintain your nonprofit tax status. That's what your general counsel is going to do for you. But whoever agrees to be on the board of the legal entity probably also needs to be clear they're acting in their individual capacity, and they may need the legal indemnification.
This is Chris. That's a fair question. I will say I think at least we know, to your first question, I think the intention is to incorporate as a nonprofit entity under the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C. And I'm not familiar with, other than that, familiar with what the requirements are. It's a fair question. And
I never intended to be as familiar as I am now.
Right. and that perhaps is something that we'll, you know, in consultation with our prospective general counsel, he may yet come back and say, you know, you need to fix this because of that, for those exact reasons. So, you know, this, just because we can tweak this the way we like it, there's no guarantee that obviously the prospective counsel would want to leave it like that. So there's going to be perhaps some discussion between the parties and figuring that out. But it's a fair question, and I guess when we get further insight on that, then we will have to deal with that. But Jimson, did you want to add anything?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Chris. And let me also appreciate Angie. She has also been part of our life trying to help solve this. So, I just want to bring out an analogy. Whenever we go to the bank, we want to open an account, you know, you have to say, sign this indemnity and so. So it's a normal, regular stuff, you know, we experience every now and then. But it doesn't mean, I've never come across a situation whereby that has happened if you keep within your operational frameworks. So if that is the case, then and we have a process. That's why the charter issue is very important. Who is qualified to stand as an officer and what have you, and the requirement for transparency, for decision-making, for accountability, and even in the ESCOM, if that is well tightened, I think it's just basic in terms of indemnification, basically. But at the same time, you know, you may say, okay, yes, this person will operate in good faith and what have you, but it's, you know, you can have a challenge, and that is why Mary Lynn made a very valid point, you know. So, maybe we'll leave it the way it is now, as you recommended. Send it to him, and let's get what he has to say, you know, about that. Because he alone is the one that has, I think, the legal responsibility. Let me be corrected. Because that is the whole idea, is to be the face.
Let me talk to you offline. You can't establish a not-for-profit status without becoming a legal entity. That's what you're trying to do. But if you're incorporating, then somebody has to be on the board of directors or hold the director role. That is typically not your general counsel. And so the other thing I would say to you is, like, I'm just going to use WAVE as an example. When we established WAVE, we had three directors, and the directors appointed the board. So we were incorporating in New Hampshire. But why don't we take this offline? What you're trying to do here is to establish the person who will act as the legal counsel. Our lawyer is not a general. WAVE's lawyer is not. They are on retainer. They are indemnified. We buy insurance for them. But WAVE is a not-for-profit organization incorporated under U.S. law. If you're establishing a legal entity, somebody's going to have to be the director or directors.
Yes, the current BC officers will have to be.
I'm not saying you can't do that, but then you will have to, since you elect officers on a yearly basis, you would have to ask your, are you going to change your directors? I wouldn't advise that.
No, but basically part of the deliverable is that every year, that you will be responsible for filing all the documentation, necessary documentation to retain our status. So if we have a change of officers, then it readily means that that's part of the changes we will do.
Sorry, Marie.
Thanks, Chris. Can I move this? No, Marie from AIM. It's for my own understanding, because American law, state law, is a total mystery to me. I get slightly nervous when I see the indemnification against the expenses and the fees and whatever. As Marilyn said, are we going to have legal insurance? Good, you're nodding, because I had this vision of them coming for joint and several liability of the individual members of the business constituency. And with all due respect to the lawyers in your country, I don't want to do that.
This is Chris. I can safely say that neither my employer wouldn't want that either. So no, the understanding would be that we would get some insurance. Yes, yeah. So why don't we do this? Let's maybe worth one, not right now with everyone, but the XCOM can have one more last go round on that. Make sure we get it. We can go ahead and send it. Taking Marilyn's point under consideration, we'll have to, you know, in consultation with counsel, we'll have to think about that issue, the issue of a board of directors and how we would structure that. So it's one more thing we'll have to think about. I mean, ultimately, my goal would be that we could finalize this by meeting B the end of June. That may be ambitious, but, you know, that's my hope, that we can get this done soon. And, it, you know, that may impact, obviously, the consideration of our charter a little bit, I hope. But I think it shouldn't stop us from considering the charter and vetting all the other issues that may be part of that. But, you know, if we can get this done in the next two or three months, at the latest, that'd be great. But it's something we're going to have to think about. So my point is, I guess we'll just leave it here. Unless there's further thoughts or concerns. Angie, did you have anything you wanted to add on? Okay. Thoughts or concerns about it, but we, the XCOM will have one more, I guess, brief chat maybe on about this in the next couple weeks, I guess, with our next BC call, after our next BC call, and then we'll report back to the membership on where we stand. But I think that's, Jimson, hopefully that'll make sense, and, you know, we can send what we send to the council, and then we'll engage in a discussion, I'm sure, with him, and maybe that we'll have to revise this further, but
that's, yes, we could actually get him to be in one of the ESCOM calls so that we can have an interaction with him.
That's a good suggestion. Maybe we do that. We'll do that. Okay. Thank you all. Oh, Marilyn. Yep, sorry.
I have something under AOB, and just a reminder, if you haven't picked up your gala ticket, be sure you do that.
Yes, and I believe the gala tickets are available at the information booth and the conference
room. My other question is goes to this BOF thing that is happening, and we talked about the possibility of canceling that. It's clear it's not going to be canceled. There are conflicts for many of you. The Vinalia is solving a different problem than perhaps we thought she was. I just wanted to know who else might be able to go to that BOF session. I'm going to go to it, but mostly I hope to just learn about what problem it is that she's solving. I've been hearing what it is, but it mostly seems to have to do with the tension between the MPOC and the ALAC and the lack of her representation. I think that's what it is, but I'm going to go for informational purposes, but I wondered who else might be able to go.
So can you remind us, this is Chris, can you remind us the time tomorrow?
Yeah, it's simultaneously. It's 5:15 to 6:30, and it's at the same time as identifier technology, health indicators, conferring with the CCT, the conferring with the Competition, Consumer Trust, and Consumer Choice Review Team, and the IDN implementation guideline session, all at the same time as the BOF.
So this is Chris. I'm happy to attend at least a portion of it, maybe the first 30 or 45 minutes of it. Which room is it again? I'm sorry, I can look. I'm on here. Okay, well, that's actually helpful because that's where we're going to be meeting. Sorry, Park. Yeah.
Oh, this is Heba. I was planning on going to it as well.
Okay,
so.
Great. So we'll have a few people, and if others can pop in, that would be that'd be good too. So let's go ahead and move on then. Angie, why don't you, if you could, give us a little update, 5-10 minutes or so on SCI. Thank you.
Sure, thank you. I am representative from the BC to Standing Committee on Implementation Improvements. Lawrence here is alternate from the BC for the SCI, and we are charged with taking GNSO Council requests for specific recommendations on process and procedure items, especially with respect to issues that occur or are anticipated. Our most recent work has been with consideration of motions. So, for example, one of our questions is, must a motion presented at the council be seconded in order to be voted on? And we decided after much deliberation, yes. Our sub-team B meeting recently has been with respect to situations where terms for chairs and vice chairs have expired at the same time. We had an issue in Dublin where we were left with no one to run the session. So we've been deliberating that. We're continuing discussions on that, and we've made great progress. If there's anybody who would like to know the specifics, they get very needly. We're happy to present that. We're also talking about timing of council chair and vice chair elections to avoid the issue altogether. And I think there is a calendar, but I'm happy to end that unless anybody's got any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, thoughts on that? Okay. Just to say, Angie, thank you very much for taking on that role, and we certainly, and Lawrence as well. Lawrence is a relative newcomer now to the BC, but thank you for jumping in on that right off the bat. And we appreciate that very much. Good. All right. Well, let's move quickly. Any other business for folks that may have? I should just say the next BC meeting will be tomorrow at noon. I think in the Omdier room. It's a closed meeting from 12 to 1:30. That may be a good opportunity for us to close the loop on, we may learn more. Well, I guess we might learn more. Well, tonight by 6, right? Tonight. Yeah, so we may have a better sense of what we may or may not need to do with regard to accountability by that time. And, we can assess the situation from there. But any other thoughts people have? Okay. Well, then, I'm giving you practically an hour back of your time. So thank you all for participating and hanging in there, and thank you for those that participated remotely. And we will talk again tomorrow. Thank you. You can stop the recording. Thanks.